Hey, welcome back for another episode of Legal Marketing Radio. So this episode of the show is going to tackle a topic that's pretty different from anything we've touched on before on the show. And we got a special guest to help us do it. James Miller is an expert in building peer networks, and he's going to talk to us about how attorneys can build a peer network that helps them solve problems and improve their practices. You know, at LaFleur, we work with a lot of small law firms and some solo practitioners too. And we know from talking with these attorneys that it can be, you know, a bit of a lonely existence from a professional standpoint, at least. So hopefully the tips and strategies in this podcast will help you connect with other attorneys, build a valuable peer network, and, you know, get some of the support and answers you need to get where you want to go. Before we get started, just a quick reminder, if you're not already familiar with LaFleur, we're a full-service digital marketing partner, and we work with law firms across the country to deliver data-driven solutions that develop their brands and grow their businesses. To learn more about us, just check out our website. We're at LaFleur.marketing. That's LaFleur.marketing. And you can find all sorts of other resources on our site, including other episodes of this podcast, blog articles, infographics, ebooks, and lots more. Okay, let's get started and begin the conversation with James Miller on this week's episode of Legal Marketing Radio from LaFleur. Okay, welcome back to the studio for another episode of Legal Marketing Radio. On the show with us today, we have a special guest. James Miller is the founder of Skybridge Associates, which is a company that designs, creates, and leads the executive peer networks that leaders need to build authentic relationships and share valuable insights. And James is a former director of MBA admissions and financial aid at Harvard Business School. And in the past 10 years, he's worked with the general counsels of more than 40 private equity firms and of about 20 growth companies. And those companies include Dropbox, Lyft, Stitch Fix, SurveyMonkey, and Blue Apron. So some major players there. James, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Stephen.
So one of the reasons you're on the show is you've got a book that you recently published that you'd like to talk about, and we definitely want to touch on that. But before we start talking about your book, I just want to get a little background on you. So your focus is on these executive peer networks, and I'm interested. It seems like, you know, kind of a niche area. And I'm wondering how you kind of settled on that as your focus, how you came to that, and what your journey was there.
Yeah, look, I think it's a, you know, like all of us, we have a journey, and I don't think we necessarily plan it. You know, it's not like I grew up dreaming of creating executive peer networks. But now that I'm doing it, I'm convinced that it's one of the most important tools that any executive needs, and frankly, most people don't have it. And so, you know, my journey, quite simply, you know, I grew up in Canada. If anyone's trying to figure out the funny accent, I have an engineering degree from the University of Toronto. I then went into investment banking for a couple of years. I was at Morgan Stanley, year in New York, year in Toronto, and then went to business school. I really, you know, interestingly, I had always planned to be a lawyer. I knew a lot of lawyers growing up, and it was sort of this unexpected twist into investment banking that prompted me to look more seriously at business school. So I did that, went to Harvard Business School, and then stayed on for about 7 years on the admissions board. And really, for me, that was a chance to get to understand what makes people tick. You know, I've always been a very curious person, and so, you know, really kind of getting a sense of what motivates people. And it's more the qualitative side of things. Business was of interest. So I did that. And then I tried a few other sort of entrepreneurial things when I left Harvard. I was with a small business for about 2.5 years. And then, you know, to your point, sort of fell into this. I mm-hmm. got to know a company that was creating groups at the time for corporate directors. This was right after Sarbanes-Oxley was passed, you know, in the early 2000s, after some of the accounting scandals. And we were putting together groups for audit committees of large public companies. And the idea was that they would talk to each other about how to kind of fulfill the requirements of this new law. And Ernst & Young was the accounting firm that was sponsoring this. So I sort of fell into this. And I found that it was both really important work. You know, the people in these groups were getting an enormous amount out of it, both the insights, but more importantly, just the camaraderie and the kind of the sense of community. and I found I was good at it. And that morphed into some work in the private equity world. And again, Ernst & Young wanted to develop closer relationships with some of their PE clients. So we created groups for them in that. And again, that also had a lot of power. So it was sort of by accident. You know, I happened to get into this, but it's been a great journey. About 5.5 years ago, I left that other firm to start my own firm, Skybridge Associates. And we don't really focus in any particular industry or any particular role. Although interestingly, we've been doing a lot of work, as you noted, with the legal profession. There seems to be a real appetite both for lawyers to be members of groups like this, but also to sponsor groups like this. It's a great way to engage with your clients. So I wrote the book. I know we're going to talk a bit about the book, but you know, I really wrote the book partly as a way to evangelize. And again, I feel a bit at times like Steve Jobs. You know, the day before the iPhone was released, we all have been using flip phones, and we didn't realize we needed a smartphone. And so I wrote the book in large measure to help explain to people why I think this is one of the most powerful tools you're probably not using right now.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's a good analogy. I haven't really heard too much about this topic before. I'm obviously not, you know, as plugged into this world as probably you are. But it seemed to me that something that, you know, definitely deserved more attention than it's getting. So let's talk about the book. The book is, and I apologize, I haven't had time to read the book. I actually, your PR person sent it to me, but I just got it yesterday afternoon. So I've only read the summaries. But, you know, you can kind of give me the rundown now, along with our listeners. The title of the book is Building Bridges, The Case for Executive Peer Networks. So, you know, overall, what's the book about and what inspired you to write this book?
So what inspired me to write it is actually an anecdote I describe in the beginning of the book. Was really almost an epiphany I had. I was standing with again, interestingly for your audience, I was standing with a lawyer. We had just finished a 3-hour roundtable meeting. We were in Midtown Manhattan, and we were looking out over the skyline. And this person said, "You know, what's your growth plan? You know, where do you see yourself growing?" And it sounds cheesy, but it's true. I looked at all the buildings, and I said to this person, "I said, look, you know, there's you know, hundreds of buildings. Everywhere you look, there are, you know." Skyscrapers, and in every one of them, there's at least a dozen people, dozens in most cases, that could really benefit from this kind of meeting that we had just had. And most people don't have it. Most people it doesn't exist, and they're settling for a life, you know, without this valuable resource. And so, what inspired me to write it was just that burning vision that, you know, there's so much that can and should be done, and so it was a way for me to both communicate what I've learned about how to do these things well, and, you know, hopefully open up a conversation. You know, I think most people have a negative view of networking, and, sure. And what I try to do is distinguish between networking, you know, the verb, and a network, which is a noun. And I think they're very different. And so for me, this was really a way of saying, look, it's not about glad handing and exchanging business cards and sort of the desperate transactional activities that people, you know, justifiably don't like.
Right, it
really is about building a sustained network of peers that you can spend time with on a regular basis. And so that was what motivated me, was a desire to kind of share that experience that I had had. The book is broken into two parts. The first part describes, I think, 8 different principles that frankly anyone should think about when you're designing a network. And these are things as simple as you know, the power of beliefs. You know, a large part of what we do is frankly help people to either reinforce or change what they believe, because, you know, my simple rules that our beliefs drive our behaviors and behaviors drive outcomes. So if you want different outcomes, it's not enough to just act differently. You have to actually think differently. And the way you think differently is just by acknowledging what you think, quite honestly. And so that's just an example. So, you know, there's 8 of these sorts of principles, trust and storytelling and some various aspects that make up kind of the core of a good network. And then we shift to the design aspect, you know, kind of how do you really think about designing one of these groups in a way that's effective, and that actually builds trust over time, because trust really is at the core of any great network. And so how do you put those together? The one thing I will say is that the book is incredibly short by design. You know, I when I first decided that I wanted to write a book, I sort of did an outline as a person would, and realized pretty quickly that my audience, which is really an executive audience, would never read a 300-page book. They just wouldn't have the patience or the interest, frankly, in reading a long book on the topic. And so I basically made a commitment to myself, and I was going to keep it very brief. It's a book that could be read in an hour. You know, the vision I live in Boston, and the vision I had was of someone throwing the book in their bag on the way to the airport and reading it cover to cover during the shuttle flight between Boston and New York. And so it's, you know, most people can get through it in about 45 minutes. There's also a podcast for those of you, not a podcast, an audio book rather. So for anyone who doesn't want to read it, you can actually listen to it, and it's available through all the usual channels. But again, it's a very digestible piece. It's about an hour long. So most people could listen to the whole thing during a typical round trip commute. So that's really what inspired me. It's been getting really great reception. I've been delighted with how people have been responding to it.
That's fantastic, and that does sound like a Steve Jobsian moment with looking out at the city. That's a great story. So before we go any further with the book, I'd like to just define this idea of an executive peer network. Can you tell me what that means to you? When I hear the term, I maybe imagine it sounds like a bunch of like CEO is like socializing or something. And I feel like that's not what you're getting at. So can you tell me what an executive peer network is to you?
Well, it can be CEOs, but I think my point is it doesn't
have more than
to be
that,
CEOs.
Yeah.
Yep. It's more than that. Look, there are groups for CEOs. There's groups of entrepreneurs. I guess what I would say is there's a lot of dialogue out there. The problem is that it tends to be fairly transactional. It tends to be fairly infrequent. And so for me, what it is, it's basically an invitation-only club. What we're effectively doing is we're creating groups of about 20 or so people who should be talking with each other on a regular basis, but aren't for whatever reason. Again, it could be a CEO, it could be a CFO, it could be a general counsel, it could be a vice president of manufacturing. It's typically people who don't, who are at a fairly senior level in their organization, to the point where they don't really have peers internally who are dealing with the same issues they are. At the junior level, there's usually dozens of people within the organization that are dealing with fairly similar issues, and so you can always talk to them if you have questions or challenges. When you start to talk about executive ranks, you typically don't have people internally who are dealing with issues and see the landscape the same way that you do.
Right.
And so inevitably you need to go outside the organization. So what we're talking about really are groups of executives in a whole range of roles who get together typically three times a year. I'm a believer in frequency, but I don't think it needs to be too frequent. I think if you were to meet every month, let's say, there could be a certain fatigue that sets in.
Yeah.
And so, you want it to be off. That's the fine balance. You want it to be often enough that there's a sense of momentum and consistency, but not so often that people see it as a burden. And so that's really what it is. It's a group of people who collectively agree to meet. And then, then the question is, well, what do we talk about?
Right.
And that's where I come in.
Yep. That was where I was going with my next question. So when they meet, is it, what kind of structure is there to that? Is there like an itinerary, or is it just sort of free form? What happens in these meetings?
Well, I really believe, and this is, from 15 years of experience doing this, that the quality of any meeting is decided long before people get in the room.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. Yeah.
If you get a group of people together and just to shoot the bull with no agenda and no sense of why they're there, then, you get what you expect. You get a lot of, typically the loudest voice dominates and they sort of move the fog around. So the agenda is something that really is critical, and that's where we put a lot of our attention, quite honestly. So, in terms of what we do, we'll recruit this group in the first place. We will spend a fair bit of time before every meeting talking with the members of the group, usually by phone. We could do it in person, but usually by phone. Those conversations are partly an opportunity to test ideas others have shared. Someone will say, maybe we ought to talk about X, Y, or Z. But you don't know if that's just one person is interested in the topic or if it's widespread or widely held interest. And so, partly we'll test ideas that people will give us and see if they they have traction. But we also are just listening for patterns. You know, we often have fairly open-ended conversations with people, and if we hear people mentioning the same issues over and over, you know, we're smart enough to figure out that there's probably something there. So, you know, we'll design the agendas well in advance. We usually put together a short pre-read that kind of tees up the issues, gives people something to think about, so that they can come to the meeting knowing, you know, why we're there, what we're going to talk about. And, you know, we're certainly flexible enough if we go kind of off, take a tangent, we can accommodate that. We're not sticking strictly to the agenda. But I think it really does help in any group to have a clear sense of why you're there and to syndicate that agenda in advance. That's effectively what we're doing. We're it's not us setting the agenda. It's really us channeling the needs of the members in doing that.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, you know, turning the conversation to attorneys a little bit, you mentioned in some of our emails when we were planning out this recording that, you know, for many lawyers in particular, the very idea of having a peer network is kind of counterintuitive. Why would you say that is?
Well, I think there's two types of needs. And I think, you know, part of the point I make in Building Bridges is that most professionals, frankly, should have two different groups. They should have a group that they are part of, so a peer group of folks like themselves that are dealing with similar challenges. And then they should have a group that they sponsor. And that's typically a group of clients or key stakeholders. And you know, we haven't really talked about that aspect of it yet. The groups, and I will get to your question, I promise, but
sure,
I want to set up the point of sponsorship first, which is that most professional service providers, whether they be accountants, lawyers, consultants, you name it, see a very small part of their clients day to day, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they're engaged to help with some piece of their client's work, or there's some piece of their client's responsibility, but they frankly don't have visibility into the rest. You know, I like to use the metaphor of the iceberg, where you see the sort of 10% above the waterline, but it's really the 90% below the waterline that you've got no visibility into at all. And yet that 90% is really what supports the 10% that you see.
Right.
And so I think there's a lot of that, certainly in the legal profession. I've worked with lawyers now for over a decade, and you know, they're excellent and very skilled at what they do, but they really don't have opportunity to see much else. And so I think that people sometimes fail to, you know, realize that. You know, you know it intuitively, but you don't really know it until you get in a room with your clients and listen to them talk to each other, which is really what we're doing. And we talk about sponsoring a group. It's about basically supporting a group for your clients, you know, and bringing, you know, 15 or 20 clients together and being a fly on the wall while they talk to each other about their most important needs, which by the way, may have nothing to do with what you do, right? And so if you're a litigator, or if you're a real estate attorney or a patent attorney, you know, they may be talking about, you know, issues around building their team. They may mm-hmm. be talking about issues around, you know, interacting with other service providers, you know, things that may not seem to have a need for you. But and so when I say it's counterintuitive, I guess what I mean is I think people are used to being an expert in what they do and failing to realize that their clients' needs are much broader, and they could actually serve their clients much more effectively, not so much by being more narrow and more focused, but rather by being broader, by having a better understanding of their clients. So I think as a sponsor, a lot of lawyers tend to maybe overvalue the expertise, the legal expertise, and maybe undervalue their ability to provide a broader counsel to their clients and understand their clients' needs at a richer level. I think that from a member perspective, similarly, I think that, you know, I work a lot with general counsel, mm-hmm. and people in you know, sort of senior legal roles, and I think similarly, a lot of them probably don't naturally think of getting involved in peer groups, you know, partly because, you know, again, there's sort of a technical aspect. And I think that recognizing that, no, you know, a lot of being a lawyer is about non-legal issues. A lot of it is leadership issues and management issues. So finding a forum to talk about those things and to talk about our careers, you know, we talk a lot about career matters. It's hard for people to do one-on-one, but I think in a group setting, it's a lot easier, safer. for a lot of people.
Sure. Yeah, I think that makes sense. You know, especially for a lot of the attorneys we work with who have, again, you know, smaller firms, even solo practitioners, you know, it is kind of a lonely existence. And I think, you know, a lot of the nature of, you know, you think of other attorneys who are in the same role as your competition. So it tends to be very isolating. So for an attorney like that, who's, you know, on a very smaller end of the scale, you know, they've got a small firm with maybe two or three attorneys, you know, maybe it's even like a father and son practice. We work with a practice like that in North Carolina. How do attorneys like that, how would they go about creating, you know, a peer network that's valuable to them? What would that look like?
So I think there's the, you know, the two ways I talked about. I think I could envision someone doing both. So I could imagine, first of all, within a local area. So, you know, let's say that you lived in North Carolina, let's say you lived anywhere, you know, within your, you know, within 30 miles of where you are, there are probably dozens, if not hundreds of people who are in a similar position. Now, they could be attorneys. They could also be other small professional services providers, right? They could be small accounting firms. They could be small consulting firms. It's a different industries, but my guess is they probably have similar types of challenges or questions, you know, hiring and firing employees, you know, finding good resources, you know, whatever it is. There's a lot of issues that people deal with that aren't specific to the practice of law. And so whether it was a matter of pulling together a group of 15 or 20 fellow lawyers, maybe from different practices, you know, again, if you're an IP lawyer, you're not really competing with someone who's a real estate lawyer or, you know, wills and estates lawyer. And so you could imagine people from different legal, sort of non-competing legal disciplines getting together regularly. But again, I don't think you would need to limit it to the legal profession. I think you could actually broaden it, which might actually add an interesting twist, give you some insights that you wouldn't have expected. So I think as a member, it's easy to imagine the value of creating one of these groups, kind of initiating it. I think as a sponsor, again, one could imagine, you know, inviting your 20 best clients to get together. You know, your 20 best clients, my guess, probably are in non-competing industries and probably have some similar challenges. And so if you provide them with an opportunity to get together, you know, A, they're going to appreciate it. You know, the brand and reputation benefits of that are enormous. You know, you're basically saying to your clients, I have your back, right? I care about you. I'm creating something for you without any expectation of being repaid. And that's a very powerful message. It's not a message that most people have an opportunity to create, to send very often. So I think I could imagine both. I could imagine being a member of a group. I could also imagine creating a group for your own clients.
Okay, I see. So if you're talking about a small firm, let's say, you know, we work with like estate planning lawyers, personal injury attorneys, all range of practices. But, you know, when you say creating a group of their clients, you mean, you know, like the everyday people that they work with?
Well, so I think that, look, this I'll be honest, this model works best in sort of a B2B context. And so if you're dealing directly with individuals, I think it's probably less likely to be valuable. It could be, but I think it's less likely to really apply. I think, you know, if you're an attorney working with, you know, smaller companies, I could absolutely see this being valuable. If you're dealing within a personal injury context, I agree. I think it's a little more difficult to create a group for your clients in that case. But certainly, if you're working with corporate clients, even relatively small corporate clients, I think something like this could be very powerful.
Yeah, I think so too. So in particular, you know, you talk about how you've seen that these kind of peer networks, you know, they help law firms get to know their clients better, you know, in ways that just wouldn't happen otherwise. Can you talk about, you know, some of the interactions you've seen, some of the ways you've seen that pay off for lawyers in particular?
Sure. Well, and as I said, you know, we've done a lot of work in the last several years in a couple of fields. And again, some of these industries, I'll admit, are probably a little larger than maybe what some of your clients are working with. But like I said, we've done a lot of work in the private equity space. Mm-hmm. In fact, I just got back yesterday. I was in New York for a group of private equity firm general counsel. You know, private equity firms, for those who don't know, are effectively buyout firms. They'll raise a pool of capital. They'll use that to basically acquire companies, and then they sell them some number of years later and share the profits with their investors is basically how it works. And so the GCs of these firms are not directly doing the deals. They have investment professionals doing the deals, but they're managing the operations of their firms. And they do get involved in some of the nuts and bolts of the transactions. And so, you know, the law firms that serve them know very well the transactional work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. But they really don't understand, you know, some of the other challenges they have within their firms. And so it's really a great opportunity for, very experienced, talented M&A attorneys to understand what their clients are dealing with. And so this group I just was at last night, two nights ago, this is our eighth meeting in the last 3 years. I had another group that met 20 times over the period of about 6 or 7 years. We also have a group, as you mentioned at the outset, of general counsel from some of the larger tech companies, growth companies. And again, the same thing, you know, these are companies that are really in hyper growth mode. I talked with one person who had joined a company. He said when he joined, there were 50 employees. Now there's 500 employees. You know, you talk about a lot of these people say their job changes every 6 months. As GC, as the company reaches different phases of development, you know, they go from being the only lawyer on staff to being, you know, managing a team of 10, you know, practically overnight. it's a dramatic change, and they really need a lot of support. So I don't think that the law firms would necessarily appreciate how hard that is, because they're just dealing with specific legal matters. And so I think those are the kinds of opportunities that we've seen for law firms to really get to know their clients in a much deeper way than they would otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think too, you touched on maybe that model of doing it with clients doesn't work for the people serving the individuals, but to talk with other attorneys, again, you know, like I mentioned, I know from experience from talking with these, you know, solo practitioners and small law firms, it can be it's a lonely existence, you know, and there's so many things you can learn from other people. So I think it makes a lot of sense, you know, to try to organize this type of network. Now, I wonder, do you ever, when you kind of propose this idea to attorneys, do you ever receive pushback? You know, one thing I'm thinking of is that attorneys tend to be pretty protective of their time. A lot of them feel like they're stretched thin. Do you ever hear them say, you know, I already interact with, you know, peers. I don't have time for this. How do you overcome maybe challenges or objections that they might have?
It's a good question. I think, look, in terms of inviting people to be a member of a group like this, you're right. I think, you know, time is the scarcest commodity that we all have. And so I think that there are some people who will say, well, I'm already a member of a group and such and such and such. But then when we describe what we do, they say, I'm not a member of a group like that. There are lots of kind of quote unquote networking groups. And these are usually, you know, ad hoc groups. They'll meet once a month or once a quarter. But there's usually no agenda. It's sort of, you know, catch as catch can. There's 100 people invited and maybe 10 will show up. You know, it that type of thing. They're really not done very well. It gets back to the design point I made at the beginning. They're not designed well.
Right.
And so they're destined to be sort of low value activities. And, you know, people only attend those if they have nothing else to do, and you know, we always have something else to do. So occasionally people will assume that that's what we do. In fact, I had the head of marketing at a fairly large law firm on the West Coast tell me several months ago, you know, Jamie, what you're really facing is people that misunderstand what you do. They think you're doing something that's different from what you're actually doing. And, mm-hmm. and I think that's true. I think when we describe what we're actually doing, people say, wow, that would be valuable. That would be worth my time. So once people understand it, I don't think there's anyone that rejects it out of hand, or very few people. From a sponsorship perspective, we get the opposite. We get people who say, you know, why would I need to, you know, to pay, or why would I need to kind of, you know, bring someone in to help me get to know my clients better? You know, I know my clients well already. You know, I don't need you. I could go for dinner with any client anytime I want. Mm-hmm. And get that. And on some level, they're right. But what I will then say is, look, you know, yes, you could invite a client to dinner. Are you going to invite the client to dinner next quarter as well? And what about the quarter after that? You know, at a certain point, it starts to feel, you know, like you're being too persistent, like you want something. And you do, obviously. There's an underlying commercial objective. And I think the beauty of sponsoring a group like the ones we run, is that it's a very natural way to engage with your clients, to spend, you know, typically 6 hours at a time, three times a year with 15 to 20 of your largest clients, and to do it in a way that doesn't feel transactional and that feels completely organic and authentic. And you just can't do that. So again, I think once people really understand the power of what we're doing, the objectives fade away. But I think the initial objective is, you know, people have a kind of preconceived mental model of what they think we're doing, which is really quite different from what we're actually doing.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think, like you said, you know, there's that context to the, or the connotation of that term networking is sort of a hurdle you have to get over because so many people have had negative experiences. So I want to circle back just a little bit and touch on, you know, we talked earlier about how, you know, one of the most important things that defines whether this is going to be a successful activity or not is setting the agenda, right? And so, you know, for the, you know, you mentioned that for the clients that you work with, you know, you guys put quite a bit of care and time into developing these agendas. You know, for attorneys who are listening, who are thinking they may want to apply this themselves, you know, they're not going to have, you know, the luxury, unless they're able to work with you, which would be great. But otherwise, if they're trying to sort of DIY this, they're going to have to do that themselves. So can you provide maybe some tips or general guidelines to get a great agenda, which is such a key component of making this work?
Absolutely. Look, I think that it the key to a great agenda is, first of all, asking the right questions and listening, you know, again, engaging with people. And look, if you're part of a DIY group, there's a couple of approaches. One is, you know, to use email or tools like that, just to kind of send a note around to say to people, you know, who has ideas for an agenda, you know, who, you know, are there things that you want to talk about? And inevitably people do have ideas. You could also have a voting mechanism. So, you know, if people have provided a set of ideas, it could be a two-stage process, right? You could have, you know, kind of send us all your ideas, we'll aggregate them and then we'll vote on them. So there's sort of a very easy, simple way of getting people to feel a sense of ownership, you know, because you don't want people to walk into a meeting saying, hey, this is their agenda and I'm just, you know, riding along. You want people to walk in and say, this is our agenda.
Yeah.
You know, we created this agenda together, right? So I think, you know, a combination of email and, you know, simple polling tools or SurveyMonkey or these sorts of tools are ways that one could set an agenda, could kind of come to an agreed upon agenda. So the other thing is about having the right questions. It's not just about having an agenda topic. It's about actually having open-ended questions. I'm a big believer in the power of open-ended questions as opposed to closed questions. And I find, we probably all find, that too many people use sort of closed yes-no questions, where the most powerful questions, particularly in a group setting, are those that are open-ended. So, you know, if you have an agenda topic, you know, it might be something like, you know, if you're talking about hiring, like, you know, so let's say you want to hire a junior teammate. You want to understand what people's experience is in doing that. You know, you want to phrase the questions, you want to kind of have the questions posed in such a way that it opens up the range of things people talk about. So that's one way to do it. I think the other possible way to set agendas is, quite honestly, with a steering committee. You know, if you have a group of 20 people, you know, you need to have some order. You don't want to have it completely chaotic. Mm-hmm. But what you can do is you can actually nominate, you know, some small number of people, three or four people, either, you know, permanently to set the agenda for the group, or maybe you rotate it, you know, so, you know, sort of it's an agreement that a month before, 3 weeks before a meeting, this group of three or four people is going to just spend 20 minutes on a conference call, you know, and they're collectively going to decide a set of issues that they think the group ought to talk about. You know, I think putting that burden on a single person is hard,
yeah.
But giving that responsibility to a group of people, again, you know, everybody knows it'll be their chance eventually. But to me, that's the most valuable. The other thing I should mention about agenda is there's different ways of thinking about it. Some groups I know, particularly groups that are self-organized, will focus on presentations, on someone coming in and presenting an issue they have or a solution they've identified. I think there could be some goodness in that, particularly if it's the group that is presenting topics as opposed to just a group discussing topics. You know, in the groups that I run, people very rarely want presentations from advisors. You know, what people will tell me is, look, if I need a presentation on a topic, I can call my law firm and I'll get a presentation, you know, that same day, typically. So, you know, they tend to value dialogue over, you know, over listening. You know, people always like to be involved in an active conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than listen passively anyway. But I think that is a part of sort of the the thought process that has to go into any agenda is, you know, how much of this is going to be kind of case study presentation, how much of this is going to be, you know, discussion. You know, there's a lot of ways to mix it up. And by the way, you know, I think over time, it should probably include, you know, a mix. And that's something for the group to decide up front. You know, I think there's always governance issues involved in any group. And I think setting the governance, the decision-making process at the beginning of any group launch is an important part of this.
Yep. Yeah, that makes sense. But I think, you know, like, you know, not to speak out of turn, but it does seem important to keep that eye on interactivity. I think, you know, at least from my personal perspective, you know, the idea of this being something where I would go to, you know, watch more presentations and, you know, attend another kind of typical business meeting is, you know, kind of counterproductive, basically.
Agreed.
So I just want to kind of now, you know, I've kind of asked you a bunch of questions, but as I mentioned, you know, unfortunately, I didn't have time to read the book. It is a slim book. I was hoping to get to it last night, but I didn't quite, you know, have the time. So, and I'm planning on reading it definitely this week. But since I haven't read it, you know, I just want to kind of open the floor up to you. Is there anything in the book you want to touch on or summarize that you think is particularly valuable for attorneys that we haven't gotten to yet?
You know, I think that what I would focus on, there's three reasons, there are three discussion topics that I think are really valuable to discuss with any group. And so I think I would want to just highlight those three topics.
Sure.
Because I think we apply universally. The first is the value of discussing what's going on sort of outside your organization. These can be trends, these can be new legislation or regulation, you know, things that are happening kind of outside the walls of your organization. And I say this as a member, right? So if you're a member of a group, you want to talk about what's happening out there. And it's not just the what. You know, you can read the what in the New York Times.
Right.
You know, your law firm probably sends you a briefing note that describes the what. So it's not the what. It's really the so what. You know, how does this matter? Does this matter? You know, what are the parts of this that I haven't really thought about? So that external discussion is, I think, really valuable always. But again, not the what or the so what. Then there's the internal matters. The second of these is anything happening internally. And these are inevitably things like policies, procedures, practices, norms, the sorts of things that your organizations are doing. And I think we all quite naturally end up in a little box. You know, we sort of assume that the way our company or our organization does it is the way that everybody does it. And that, of course, is not true. And so just understanding better, you know, what types of practices people in our position are experiencing. More importantly, why, right? So the key question there isn't what, it's actually why. Because every organization is different. Every organization has different needs, different culture, and that will obviously dictate different policies and practices. But understanding the nuances of why they've made the choices they have, I think, is incredibly powerful and valuable. So that's the second. And then the third source of value of any of these groups is, as I mentioned earlier, just around career and personal development.
Yeah.
You know, we all are looking for ways to grow. We're all looking for you know, ways to balance our work and our life. We all have similar questions, or many people have similar questions. And just, you know, talking about those things, it's those are the kinds of things you can't read in the newspaper. You know, you really have to talk about live. And so those are the three points, I guess, that we haven't talked about that really are valuable. And for many people, you know, getting back to your agenda question, you know, should constitute the types of issues that are on an agenda for a group discussion.
Yeah, really good idea. Good ideas. I'm glad we touched on those, and thank you for bringing that up. Okay, James, we've got to wrap up here. Just before we go, how does it feel to be done with the book? Are you, you know, enjoying free time, or are you already on to the next thing? What are you up to now?
Well, I wish I was having more free time. In fact, if anything, I think I have less free time. In part because I'm both promoting the book, which
right,
is a fun activity. You know, I love, as you can tell, I love talking about this.
Yeah.
I really do believe very much in the power of this. So, you know, having the book as a catalyst has been fantastic. But I also am finding that you know, there's a lot more traction. I think the more I talk about the book, the more people want to talk to me about creating groups like this, which is fantastic. And so, you know, we're spending a lot more time in execution and designing new groups. It's really been wonderful.
Yeah, that's great to hear. It sounds like it's been a fun trip for you. All right, James Miller is the author of Building Bridges, The Case for Executive Peer Networks, And I highly suggest you pick this book up. I am planning on reading it this week, and even the summaries that I've received on it, really interesting. And the book is available on Amazon. And if you're looking for it, make sure to spell James' name right. It's even though it sounds Miller, it's M-I-L-L-A-R. And we'll provide a link to the book in the show notes. James, thank you so much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it. It's been a fun conversation. Thanks, Stephen.
You too. Okay, that's it for this week's episode. We hope you enjoyed our conversation with James and that you're feeling inspired to go out and start developing your own peer network. Don't forget to check back next month for another new episode of the podcast. And if you got a question or a suggestion for the show, just send an email to radio@lafleur.marketing. As always, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Legal Marketing Radio from Lafleur.